Welcome back to another episode of The Happy CEO. This is our new title, by the way. I'm Sebastian Mirau, and today I'm joined by someone who sits right at the intersection of longevity, purpose, and well-being, Markus Hirs. Markus is the author of Your Exceptional Life. You got copies here, right? We have to, yeah. Make the rest of your life the best of your life. A keynote speaker, the creator of the Exceptional Life Blueprint, really excited to talk about that. And on his website, he describes himself as, I don't know if you know, magnificently obsessed with helping people creating their exceptional life. Just the conversations we have, like, you know, that ties really in with your overall being, I would say. His career began in media, huh? Producing radio and television, and even covering the Athens Olympics and the FIFA World Cup before turning his focus to what it truly means to live well, age gracefully, and thrive in every areas of life. What makes Markus such a valuable guest to the happiest CEO is not that he's a very amazing human being, which is always number one, of course. He has a depth of curiosity and his ability to translate wisdom into practical steps. We can do that. And he's interviewed by hundreds of extraordinary people across health, mindset, and longevity to uncover what makes life not just longer, but richer and more meaningful. Whether you're a business leader, parent, or simply someone who's seeking enlightenment, Markus brings stories, framework, and tools to help us all craft our own vision of an exceptional life. Welcome, Markus.
Thank you so much, Sebastian. And if it was Matteo that wrote that intro, it's one of the great intros. I am a little bit humbled and
you can have a copy
of the words in there. I might have a copy and read that to my kids at dinner tonight.
Yeah, that's right. Just behave that little bit better because I'm actually really awesome.
Wikipedia. We've known each other for years. We've got 9 kids between us. Mm. We both live in the same neck of Australia, but to actually have some quality time together.
That's our college. Yeah, that was pretty naughty, but good.
Often you bought a bunk bed from us many years ago.
Oh, many years ago.
And again, for like a 5-minute and because you're so strong, you literally loaded it into your van so quickly.
Good memory. Yeah.
Nice to have some quality time with you and look forward to this conversation.
Me too, Markus. Problem that we have is that there's so much we could talk about. And we have already touched on quite a few different topics, but I think what would help the listener just to sort of like put you in perspective. So you had a life before this life of looking into longevity and anything that comes with that, blue zones and so on. Any particular reason why you left the media?
Oh, absolutely. There was. Love was the reason. I was a binge drinking, cigarette smoking, Red Bull guzzling, hamburger eating sports journalist.
Yeah.
I loved it.
Yeah.
But I fell in love with my now wife, Sarah, who is a health professional, chiropractor by profession. She's never smoked a cigarette, has the healthiest diet. And here I am falling in love at the age of 23, 24. And I get home from work one night. Well, I worked at a TV show called The Footy Show, for those people that know their sport. And I get home thinking of BB, Victoria Bitter, and cigarettes. Sarah's half asleep and she's like, oh, what's just hopped into bed? Like, yeah, this unhealthy thing's not going to go so well, particularly if we are going to get married and have kids. And so for the 85th time, I tried to quit smoking and I was successful. And then we attended a Tony Robbins event. I remember this. And there was a challenge to do a 10-day meat-free challenge. And we went 10 days without meat, loved it. I was surprised at that. And then so we did 30 days vegetarian and then we became vegetarian. And then we became vegan, and my nickname at the Footy Show office went from MP or PC to Mung Bean. I was now known as Mung Bean at Channel 9. But I was a raging vegan and so, so happy. Yeah. To the point where I left the media, we moved to Europe, gave up alcohol, and was so vegan, I started shaving with avocado. I thought that in life, even though in Ireland, avocado trees don't grow. That's where we lived on 100 acres in a thatched cottage. I'm going to get avocados from Kenya and just smear them over my face. And I have found the secret to longevity, the fountain of youth. And I thought I'd made it until I realized how wrong I was. But that's a story that I'm happy to share, but I don't of the mic too much.
Yeah, yeah, no. Wow, so avocado, does that work?
You know why my skin is just so amazing.
Yeah, I've noticed. Yeah.
No, I don't shave with avocado anymore. But I'll tell you where this all came unraveling. Anyone that's ever had a Baskin Robbins ice cream,
you'll keep going.
Yep, I will. John Robbins was the heir to the throne of Baskin Robbins ice cream, and he grew up swimming in an ice cream cone shaped swimming pool, having ice cream for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. But his uncle Bert Baskin died midlife in his 50s or 60s of heart disease and so on. And his dad, Irv Robbins, had really poor health. And John Robbins is like, I don't think I want to inherit the family business. It's just making people ill. It's killing my family. It's a billion-dollar company, but I don't think it's my life's purpose in the next chapter. Hmm. So he escapes out of America, ostracizes himself from the family, moves to the backyard of Canada with his girlfriend, sprinkling kale seeds and cabbage seeds, teaching meditation for a gold coin donation, and becomes vegan, and becomes the preeminent vegan author on the planet. Oh. And so one day, we're now back in Australia, I read a book for what we would call confirmation bias. So you want to invest in crypto, you read a book on crypto. You want to invest in real estate, so on. So I'm a vegan going, well, I'll read Healthy at 100 by the number one vegan author on the planet, and it will tell me how good I am being vegan. And I get to the second page of the introduction, and Robbins references a study done by the Yale School of Public Health. And this study asks 600 people over the course of 20 years, Sebastian, as you age, you become less useful. Agree or disagree? Don't answer it. Sebastian, as you age, you realize it's all downhill from here. Agree or disagree? Sebastian, as you age, you realize your best years are behind you. Agree or disagree? And for the listeners, I would highly recommend that you consider your answers to the questions, because what this study found was that those people that had a disempowered view of getting older, those people that thought their 20s or their 30s were their best years, that it was all downhill from here, that you have to slow down as you get older, you're a burden on your family and the tax system and the health system and society, those people that had a disempowered view of their future died 7.5 years earlier than people that had an empowered view of getting older.
Mm-hmm.
And this study didn't measure their genes, didn't measure their wealth, didn't measure their jobs, didn't measure their exercise levels, how many friends they had, how many kids, whatever. And sadly, as a raging vegan who had given up alcohol and shaving with avocado, it didn't measure their diet. Mm. All it measured was a belief. Mm-hmm. So my whole big thing is, so we are not necessarily what we eat, but we are what we believe. And the more that I've studied this over the years, you can have the best diet in the world, but if you have no friends, you can't stand your job, you've spent more than you earn, you're bored out of your brains, and you don't enjoy your life, how important really is the organic chicken salad and the green smoothie that we're having? And so that kind of opened up a whole new world of like, have I been barking up the wrong tree for 7 or 8 years? And then started a podcast called 100 Not Out, where we've been interviewing centenarians and graceful ages for the last 12 or 13 years. I think we're the world's, if not Australia's, longest running podcast on longevity, because I realized how wrong I was just barking up the nutrition tree and forgetting about other areas of life.
That's fascinating. And I'm sure you have found more confirmation that that's true by interviewing them and seeing actually. I mean, I can think about one. Well, my granddad was 93, but I was always amazed when I was really pure eating, you know, no sugar. Actually, you know, raw vegan for some years.
Yeah.
And seeing her, you know, I wouldn't say she would eat bad, but, you know, there was certainly no focus on like, don't do too much bread or, you know, or no pudding after dinner or the occasional schnapps or what have you, know, that type of thing. But what was really obvious that she had a really positive outlook in life, really, really positive and infectious, actually. And so reflecting back on her, you know, every other day, it seems, I can see that must have been her secret, right?
And you remember that. I mean, this is the thing. There is a spark on what I call often a spunk about older people that have done really well in their life.
Yeah.
That they have succeeded at living, not just one area, but they've succeeded at life. You remember those people. You know those people. Yeah. They have a place in your heart and soul. Yeah. And, you know, this sounds really brutal, but if we just go along coasting at a 5 or 6 out of 10 in most or all areas of our life, I don't want to say it too loudly, but it's not going to be the most memorable life. It's not going to be filled with these incredible, you know, characteristics of life. You remember your
Was it your grandmother? Did you say? Yeah, you remember because she had something about her.
And, yeah, yeah.
You know, I do think if she was a raw vegan for 50-odd years and was just telling you all day long to not eat meat or not do that or not drink this or not, I mean, it's less of a, it's less of a legacy.
Yeah, wow. And so you have traveled the world and went to places like Blue Zones.
Mm-hmm.
How did you find out about Blue Zones? So that's sort of like a link in between. That happened.
Yeah, well, the National Geographic identified these Blue Zones, which are very on trend these days, but this stuff's been around for over 20 years. Dan Buettner was seconded by National Geographic to travel the world, look for places with greater longevity and quality of life. Heavily data-driven, demographers and everything. Some people have come out and said that it's all a scam and a fake. And to that, I say that person's never been peer review published, has never passed the peer review stage of research. But we've got to be really mindful here that when you look at people that live a great long life and you go to these blue zones, so for those people that are new to this, Ikaria, the little Greek island near the Turkish coast, you know, the Icarus story, the melted wings, that's Ikaria, the island where people forget to die because 80% less dementia on Ikaria, 50% less heart disease and 20% less cancer. Sardinia, not all of Sardinia, not probably the Instagram version of Sardinia, but there's 14 little villages in the middle of the mountains, in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the island that no one goes to where they still live great long lives. Interestingly, Sebastian, for every 6 centenarians on the planet, 5 are women and 1 is a male. But in Sardinia, it's 1 to 1. And that's a really curious piece. And then you've got Okinawa in Japan, but that's dying because it's a US military base. The centenarians are fine, but they're burying their children and their grandchildren because they're eating all the KFC and the McDonald's. And so they've taken on that very Western lifestyle whilst the elders are actually thriving and going well. But we're going there next year to take a small group to people to say, look, here's what's happening when people stop living, not just their tradition and their culture, but that slower pace of life that we know is really well. And then Nicoya, Costa Rica and Loma Linda, California. So they're the blue zones. But yeah, we started going there in 2016, had read about them, had learned about them. And it was just time to take our listeners there. So we've been doing 10-day trips to those places for the last decade. But you learn that you don't have to live in these places to live a great long life. You just soak up some of their wisdom and then apply it, whether you live in Byron, live in Sydney, live in New York, wherever you live. It's all about learning from other human beings as what it takes to live a great long life.
You were saying that because they're eating KFC or, you know, adopting a Western lifestyle. Now, earlier you said, look, it's not about all the diet, right?
Yes.
So can you specify sort of like there must be a little bit more to it or it's a blend of
course. And this is the nuance of life and great for you to have the courage to ask that question because people take this literally. I'm not saying that having KFC and Macca's is going to kill you.
Yep.
When it's a habit, I mean, you and I have got kids. You're saying, oh, we don't watch a lot of stuff, but when we do, they really love it. I was like, that's the attitude to nutrition.
Yep.
I'm not an alcoholic, but when I was not drinking alcohol, then my dad is proposing to his now wife, Brenda, in Bali. And I'm like, I just want to clink a beer and have one Corona with my dad.
Yes.
Why do I have to be so dogmatic that I either drink or I don't drink? Because a lot of people, yes, they do struggle with actually having one beer. I can have one beer. I'm a two-pot screamer. I have 2 beers and I'm wobbly. So I'm not the type of person that can have, you know, 10 beers or whatever.
Whatever.
So, but that's where we seem to be in this space of nutrition and alcohol now. It's like you drink or you don't drink. You have McDonald's or you don't have McDonald's. You know, if you have McDonald's today, you're not going to die. Mm. But if that becomes a habit for you where it's every second day or it's 3 times a week or whatever it is, that's a habit that a lot of people struggle to shake.
Mm.
And then they pay the price, not just through their waistline, but then through their energy levels. And then that's a slippery slope of, oh, I'm too tired to exercise. And then their productivity at work falters. And then their productivity at home and their present time consciousness with their family and their friends. And they're too tired to socialize. And so it impacts every area of life, impacts and infects every other area of life. And we've become so, I say dogmatic, but like we're trying to compartmentalize every area. But your work impacts your wealth. Your wealth impacts your social life. Your wealth impacts your family and the types of holidays that you go on with your family and your friends. What you read impacts the conversations you have at work and with your friends and with your family. Like we can't be so simple to compartmentalize every area of life. We have to, again, I say we have to romanticize life and blend every area of life into it. We don't have work-life balance. That's not a thing. You can have work-life blend. Work-life balance almost presupposes that work is separate to life, and then there's a guilt complex inside of it because you're guilty when you're working because you're not in your life. I mean, what a joke. Work is a part of our life that defines many of us. And again, my wife is what we would call a stay-at-home mum, if you're allowed to say that these days, where her work is raising children. And that's probably the most noble, incredible, impactful job that one could ever have. So it's not a work-life balance. We have to blend all areas of our life. And nutrition is no different. If you're going to have KFC, that's fine. You're not going to die. Enjoy it. Embrace it. Why is it that centenarians that we've interviewed, Australia's oldest man, would have a coffee and cake at morning tea and coffee and cake at afternoon tea and a coffee at midnight to help him sleep? It may as well be KFC, but he's enjoying his coffee and cake with friends. He's not doing it by himself. You know, he was 111. He'd have like a girlfriend in her 90s next door, and then he'd go to his other girlfriend in her 80s, two doors down. But these are just, being a little bit loose here. But what I'm saying is he was enjoying it with other people.
Yes.
It wasn't, oh, I'm too busy to eat well, so I'll rush through the drive-thru and slam down a quarter pounder and guzzle down a Coke.
Yeah.
This is lifestyle-driven stuff. I've got to be very mindful of life design, not just calories in, calories out.
So it's really the attitude that you have during that time. Like guilt will be the opposite, right? Like if you're guilty, and that would be number one.
You go to the Blue Zones, they love wine. As we say, this is not a health camp. Yeah. They love their wine, but they're not having wine by themselves, and they're never drinking to get drunk. Wine for them, like good food, brings people together. Wine brings people to the table. Would you love a wine? Yes, but there's bread and there's cheese there. They'll put water in their wine so that elongates the social experience. It makes it go for longer because they can absorb it more easily when it's got a bit of water in it. They're eating whilst they're drinking because that slows down the absorption, the digestion of the alcohol. They'd never drink on an empty stomach. In Australia, we say eating is cheating because we want to get drunk more quickly. I mean, it's disgusting our attitude and our culture around alcohol. You go to cultures that have been around for longer than we have, and there's a reverence to the alcohol. I grew these grapes in my backyard.
Right.
This is my wine or my brother's wine or my husband's wine or my dad's wine. And same with the bread and same with the goat cheese and whatever it is. And it brings people together and there's a reverence around it. We don't have that so much in this fast-paced Western culture.
But that's the key.
That's the key. And that's why you have memories of your grandmother and whether it's around food or alcohol, there was a reverence to it. She wasn't slamming it down in a rush, too busy. It was a part of the social dynamic. And that's why we love good food, good wine, good experiences in you have fine dining restaurants, because that's where the memories are made. You don't have to have fine dining at home, but the memories are around the dining table. They're not in front of the TV on the couch with a tray. Like, it's the human being that is the factor in the food and the alcohol. It's not the food and the alcohol. It's the humanity that attracts.
Something that recently, do you want some oolong?
Love some.
Right, okay.
It's not bitter. You haven't steeped it for too long, have you?
Well, you've tried. You see where we're at. I spoke recently to a hairdresser friend of mine in the barbershop, and he was talking about that most of his friends who have kids, in fact, 12 out of 13, he said, don't gather for a meal, you know?
Don't gather for a meal.
No, you have the breakfast bar and you know, you have the TV where things are happening. He said, but they don't come together, and there is not that expectation. Because, you know they're part of society where people say, oh, you don't want to force certain things onto your kids, which I'm the absolute opposite of.
I'm the opposite of.
Yeah. Like, they're really clear rules. And, well, and you know, I haven't studied this stuff, but what I can tell you is, like, I grew up with clear rules and I just accepted them. And I don't think I'm sort of particularly, it didn't taint my character that I was told not to do certain things, that I'm not allowed to just watch television whenever and all the rest of it. And I was looking for, like, how strong are these boundaries really? If I do this, like, would they even?
As you get older, you test the boundaries. That's like the growth of life.
Yeah, it's intelligence, really. Like, there's nothing wrong with it. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and I went all the way to sort of like, not so much stealing, but, well, you know. I did.
I definitely stole when I was younger.
I cracked the odd candy automat.
Yep.
Yeah. At night. Sort of way. Yeah, yeah. But I never did it with, like, decide the point. Yes. So I did stuff like that, talking about boundaries, right? And then I look at my kids. I don't know. I mean, they are. I heard once, and that really helped me. You say, like, I think 10 times no and one time one. This is how you establish boundaries because, and one time yes, you say yes. So you say way more often no than yes to sort of state the terrain that is for a young child, you know, and then the terrain becomes bigger and so on. And there will be more yeses than there were before. But to me, it's like, this is actually my job. This is how I mark territory that is safe for them. This is not safe for them.
Correct.
And I found it interesting that people say, you know, you don't want to say no. But when it comes to the road and kids sort of like playing up the road, then parents become really strong with them and say, like, no.
Exactly.
Whereas, and I found that's strange to me that a child can play up at home. It really terrorizes the parents and or doesn't let them sleep because the child just decides not to go to sleep. Mm-hmm. To me, that's not an option. Mm-mm. It's like, then you lie there awake. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't like the light off. It will be that way. I'm scared. Yeah. Not for long. Let me give you a couple of tips. Figure it out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and when that's, I think when someone tells it with certainty, like, this is the way, you feel less like, let me figure out whether there's a boundary too, or whether this is okay or not. Yes, every child is individual. I definitely, you find that probably as well. Like, you
absolutely.
Know, yeah, right. Yeah. But overall, I think that there's something to be said of just strong boundaries and structure.
Well, let's just get really brutal on this, because this is where life becomes unforgiving. If you don't create boundaries, not just in your family, but in your life, the consequences are disastrous. So 42% of all dementia would disappear if we were sufficiently physically active. This is from Professor Michael Woodward, who used to be on the board of Aging Australia. And that means 30 minutes a day. So if you have this no boundary of like, I'm too tired, I'm too busy to exercise, I'm too this, whatever, guess what? You're making plenty of time. 9 years diagnosis to death when you're older and you go down to the bakery to buy bread and you can't remember how to drive home. So no boundaries around movement, that's fine, but there's consequences. No boundaries around friends. So you're too busy to socialize, you know, I've just got so much work on and family, this and what, and you're too busy to socialize, too busy to even call your friends. Guess what? You get to 50 or 60, your kids move out of home, you might retire from work, you might exit a business, and you've lost the art of talking to strangers. You don't know how to make friends. Nah. Well, the consequences of no boundaries there. Nutrition, we've already spoken about. A third of all cancer and a third of all diabetes is a direct result of obesity. You don't get obesity having green chicken salads. You get obesity by having all the party pies and all the fast food and being too busy to eat well. So we can drop boundaries on any area of life.
Yeah.
And there are consequences. You become regretful that you didn't work the way you wanted to. Cognitive decline because you were too busy to exercise. You get lonely and that leads to depression, and people that have depression are 2 times more likely to develop dementia. You are too busy to eat well and you got no boundaries. You risk disease. You become bitter in your family. You become bored because you got no hobbies. You're broke because you don't have any boundaries around your wealth, and you're spiritually broken because you don't have any boundaries around your heart and soul. Like, I'm a big fan of boundaries, but the consequences are dire when we don't.
That, yeah. And if you like create really extreme boundaries, let's say, because you actually have to survive. So the boundaries are really like, you can't just slack off because you have to maintain your fields and, you know, all of that. Life becomes really simple. And I think within that, you find joy, because that's something that we can do. And so I find you don't have to have a lot to be happy. In fact, it's probably harder. And you know, we both know quite successful people and quite wealthy people and people that have lots going on.
Yeah.
That's not related to happiness in any shape.
They're going through a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
This is the thing. We're both fortunate to have some very, very wealthy friends, and you get to know them and they're just like everyone, and they've got the same challenges, and it doesn't necessarily at all mean there's an element at times that wealth makes life easier, but wealth can also make life pretty complicated as well.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean you don't go for it and make it happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's definitely not the more money makes you happier. I mean, there's been studies on that as well. I think the numbers are very low when it comes to wealth and happiness. So I think it's important that, my personal perspective is that wealth is one of the great quality of life amplifiers, particularly in Australia. You never want to you never want to have a goal to retire on the pension. It's relative poverty. Any pension scheme is relative poverty, in that relative poverty being less than 50% of the median income. But you can't get on a plane to go and see your kids or grandkids when you're on the pension. You can't buy beautiful food or go to the gym or go to the theater to watch Hamilton and do things, because it's not there. So certain areas of life in my research are massive longevity ingredients, and then others are quality of life ingredients. And you need both. You can't have longevity or lifespan, as they like to call it these days, without quality of life. It's a hollow victory, as I like to say.
Fascinating. Now, you just tying that in what you were saying a little bit earlier. Do you like that tea?
I love that tea. Yeah, hasn't been stooped too long.
No, not bitter at all. Not bitter at all. Yeah. No, I like a good oolong there, which is, by the way, it's sort of like a mix of green tea and normal tea.
Yeah. It's really nice.
Thank you.
I haven't seen your fridge, your tea fridge, though.
I'm really curious. No, it's my thing. It just stays longer. But fresh tea is actually better than sort of like 2-3 year old tea.
So I bring mountain tea and herbal tea back from Ikaria every 12-month supply. I'll have you over for tea. I've got some tea there that you will never have had in your whole life.
Yeah.
And you'll appreciate it. I don't know many people that would appreciate it. You would appreciate it.
Tea is amazing. Just really quickly on the Greek tea. That's a mountain tea, right?
Yeah.
Do you know much about it?
I don't want to say that they're coy on it, but it's very difficult to actually get the ingredients. It says mountain tea.
Yeah.
But, you know, next to the mountain tea, there's the sage tea. I've come back with a new tea that is a type of mint tea. People listening that know their botanicals would know it. It's something penny. So mountain tea, I don't think is an actual specific one ingredient. Mm-hmm. I think because every time I bring mountain tea back, it could be something different. And the mountain tea I brought back this year looks like a type of hops.
Yes. I know that one.
You know that one?
Got that in.
But then I've had other mountain tea that doesn't look like that at all. So, but Ikaria is pretty loose. So they might just make it up as they go, but they just love their. They love their tea. They're very conscious, though, that a lot of their tea, like rosemary as an example, acts as a diuretic. So, and, you know, hot weather over there and so on. So when we take our groups over there and they're like, oh, this, you know, rosemary tea is amazing. They're like, don't have too much.
Yeah.
It is a diuretic. So, yeah.
Well, what I've heard about the mountain tea, when you put it together with sort of honey and maybe sage as well, it's great for, you know, getting over. I don't know any ailments that you might have, actually.
Yeah. I'm a fan. I don't know if it's a little cult or not, but I'm a fan of mountain tea. Oh, well, just the way they do things in Ikaria, in any culture, when you see, because again, I often say Australia doesn't have, you know, we're not old enough to have this type of culture, but the way their healing arts work is very much passed down generation to generation, you know, like the tinctures with olive oil and just basil that just sits in there for a long time. And then their reverence for honey. You know, they have four types of honey depending on the season, and you know, it's pine and thyme, or it's pine, or it's heather honey. Like the way that they have this reverence, and they will just have their honey like that. But in Australia or the West, we're talking about glycemic index, and then you've got the vegan conversation around honey and so on. And so none of that is a thing for them. It's just, no, this is really good stuff, and it comes from the mountains, and the bees make it, and it's amazing. And you know,
so reverence. There's no excess, like people don't do anything in excess?
I don't think so. Like, they love alcohol, they love food, but they never drink. They love tipsy. Like, they're really cheeky, the Ikarians. But even in Sardinia, I would say that as well. Like, in Sardinia, I would say, you know, one of the guys said, you drink a little, we drink a lot. Like, they love their wine.
Yeah.
But it's steeped in culture.
Yeah.
There's really, you would almost call the studies disconcerting. I'm not sure if you've come across Rosetto, Pennsylvania, but Malcolm Gladwell really popularized this study in his book Outliers, where the heart disease epidemic was sweeping through America, but there's this little village that are just not dying from heart disease. Why? How? Like, this is an epidemic across the whole nation. This little village, Rosetto for the Italians, they had immigrated from Rosetto, Italy, to Rosetto, Pennsylvania, made their own village. They're obese because they're not getting access to the food. They're just making pizzas and pastas. They are defying a lot of the health profile in terms of health. They're like, don't have the health. but they're not dying from heart disease.
Mm.
Like, why? How?
Yeah,
like,
about that,
they're
actually,
obese.
Yeah.
Like, they're overweight. Mm. The researchers effectively gave up. They did all this research. They couldn't figure it out until one day one of the researchers is walking down the street and he's like, oh, my gosh. They all stop and talk to the neighbors.
Yeah.
They're slow in their lifestyle. When they go down the street, it's not just to do something. It's to see people and to hang out. They sit in the little piazza or on the park bench talking to friends for an hour, for 2 hours. Like, we don't see this in other parts of America.
Yeah.
And, you know, so the outcome of all of that is they avoided the heart disease epidemic through a major factor being their social connection, their family connection, their human connection. And, you know, this is a pretty sad statement, but so many people I speak to in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, I do a lot of speaking for the retirement village sector, but then I do a lot of speaking in corporate where the age profile is younger. Their social lives are the biggest missing ingredient.
Mm.
You know, it's like, I'm not having enough quality time. I have very little quality time with people that I love. Families could have quality time around the dining table, but to your stat earlier, 12 of 13 people of the local barbers, you know, group are eating dinner in front of the TV.
Mm.
We've got the opportunity. This is not a time thing. This is a values thing. And we think that our social lives don't have an impact on our health. I can't stick a needle in your arm, Sebastian, and go, oh, you have a coffee with Mason once a week and you've got all of these other friends and you love your life. I can't stick a needle in your arm and prove that.
Mm.
But I can stick a needle in your arm and go, vitamin C down, vitamin D down, you know, all of these B vitamins and so on. Our social lives are a nutrient to our longevity and quality of life that far exceeds our nutrition profile. No one wants to admit it. Science can't explain it. But when you look around the world, you go and see the graceful ages of the world, they do socializing better than anyone that I've ever met.
So research just has not yet figured out actually how to measure it. And I think there is
how to prove it.
How to prove it, right? Because you can measure probably like oxytocin and you know, other happiness hormones flow when you have a good conversation, when you see a friend, when you see a loved one. That makes a lot of sense. And I can see, you can see the upside of it. So
you can go to, again, it happens in Australia, but we have a much more fractured longevity profile in Australia. So again, I use Sardinia or Icaria as an example because that's where a lot of my experience is. But you go there and they're sitting in the piazza. They could be 102 and be on a walker, but their eyes are bright. They've got a smile on their face. They're with their mates. Their whole body is animated. That is not the picture of 102 years of age that many people consider. They think of a nursing home, of a stooped over man or woman, maybe with dementia, with no social engagement, eating some fast food, meals on wheels, microwave meal. They don't see living either independently or with other people that they love, catching up with their mates every day. And you ask these people, like, why do you come down here every day? And it's like, I love to see my mates. We make up stories of our childhood. You know, I remember in our 20s, we did this and we did that. But they are so animated because they've got a great social life. We just said, who cares how much money you've got? If you're bored and lonely, you can't buy that
stuff.
It's
worth nothing. Yeah.
You know,
that is really interesting. For me, you know, I mean, I have a social life, but what was important to me, because I do love what I do and I love what we're building, you know, that type of wellness company was always a dream of mine and it sort of came to life. And
I think it more than came to life. It's a thriving entity.
Thank you. Thank you. Very thriving. And one of the things that we have installed over the year, me and my team, is that I normally do the culture check interview, which is the last interview. And it doesn't matter whether it's a team member, manager, or, you know, whoever, even if they are overseas, I have the last meeting with them online if it's overseas. And I see whether they will fit in with the team and will enjoy the team and vice versa. Mm. It's really sort of like that check. And the result of that is that I love coming to work because I get on with the people there,
correct,
you know.
That's social. Let's just be clear. When I say social, it's your connection to humanity.
Yeah, okay.
Your family life is social. Your work life is social. Your friends' life I played touch football last night with my son, and a lot of strangers in Mullen at the, like, I don't know the people on the team,
yeah,
but we're all having a great time.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes,
so
yes. So the relationship can be anything. Yeah. Yeah.
So from a corporate speak or a business speak, if you've got great culture, typically it's because you've got great people, because people create the culture.
Yeah.
It's the same in family. If you've got a great family culture, it's because people feel comfortable to be the best version of themselves. So social at the different phases of our life, because we've got 9 kids between us, 15 and under, like a lot of our social revolves around our family life and our work life. And then we're squeezing in time to have a coffee with mates or an activity here, go to the gym with a friend or whatever it is. But we've got to be really mindful here that when we say social on a deeper level, it's connection to humanity.
Yeah. Okay. That
so
makes
don't
sense.
Put yourself down and say, not you specifically, but don't say I don't have much of a social life, because you do. We're socializing right now, but you're also working. So we're multitasking here.
That's very interesting. I would say I'm a bit of a hermit. I remember the first time I moved out from home, I would go to Berlin and just experiment sort of like with my sleeping and waking. And, you know, at one stage it was completely tipped and I would go to bed at 5 a.m. and would only wake up when the bakery just was open for my breakfast, because I would, you know, go through the night. Had hardly any social contacts, but it was important to me that I talked to the bookshop owner that was just around the corner. Mm-hmm. Because I got on with him and it was just that I just wanted to have this little conversation.
It's a little piece.
It's a little piece. Yep. And then I think years later, I was living on an island and quite isolated on purpose. I enjoyed that because I enjoy my thoughts and I was focused on stuff. But it was important to me just to have these little touch points every day. And it might be the cafe, you know, and, you know, the barista and or in the veggie shop, whatever you have. To me, that was essential. I knew it was essential, even though you could say, like, well, you didn't even know the name.
That's right. Yeah. So in the modern world, and your story is so beautiful, I think a lot of people are embarrassed to say that they're introverts.
Mm-hmm.
They think because social media has made an extroverted world out of everyone and everything, people are like, oh, I'm an introvert.
Right.
As in, like,
I haven't figured it out.
Well, it's like, I haven't figured out how to do big groups. And I want to see people all the time. Uh-huh. It's like this deficiency I have. No. It's so like, know thyself. You thrive. Yep. As you just said, you love silent. I'm a raging extrovert. I thrive off other people. So to use an analogy here, and I hope the listeners get this. Introverts are like batteries or like smartphones. Mm-hmm. You wake up on 100%. And the day takes your battery down, down, down. So you get home at the end of a work day and you're not necessarily super chatty because your energy is lower. Extroverts are like wind turbines. People give us energy, whether it's 8 a.m, 8 p.m, 2 a.m. If we've got people around us, we can find energy almost at any time.
Yeah.
But the challenge that we have is to not just know our style. Extroverts thrive on big groups. Introverts thrive on smaller group contact, mm-hmm. like the bakery and just saying hi to people, even if you don't know them. Introverts love smaller groups. Extroverts, bigger groups. But the biggest key is to know what you like. So if you're at a business conference I've seen you at a business conference with 500 people in a room, you're probably really socially exhausted at the end of that day. And you just need to go into a cave.
Yeah, yeah.
An hour or two and talk to no one. And as a speaker, I'm often, if I'm talking to a speaker who's an introvert, I know they don't like the socializing before the event and after the event, because for them, they've got to put all their energy onto the stage. Actors are often like this. We think they're these raging extroverts. They're introverts. They want to put all their energy into the performance. And then they're cactus after that. They're done. The battery on the phone is out.
Yeah.
But extroverts are happier to be in more social engagements. We've just got to know ourselves and then play that game.
Accordingly. Yeah. That's fascinating.
Interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, that event or one of the events where you saw me, I would probably have sat, if I could, in the corner, like, or close to the wall somewhere, you know, where at least.
At the back.
Where there are less people, or, you know, like at least I can sort of like suss out how many people there are. Yeah, isn't that interesting?
And people think it's wrong. It's not wrong. We're just different.
Like,
I'm not saying you think it's wrong. I'm just saying a lot of people come to me. Yeah. Embarrassed to go, I'm introvert, you know, almost like, can you help me become extroverted? I was like, no, let's just help you be the best version of you.
Yeah.
You know, and extroverts often marry introverts often marry extroverts. That ain't changing.
That's where I'm sort of nostalgic about maybe how the olden times were. So I grew up in a small German village, you can almost say. And, you know, in that particular part of the village, everyone knew everyone else.
Yeah.
And there's quite a bit of social code. So it's perfectly fine to ask someone whether you can use their trailer, for example. Yeah. But it's also understood that the trailer comes at least as clean back as it was before. Mm-hmm. And that there is some sort of, you know, gift. Like he got a, I don't know,
a bottle of something.
Jim Beam or whatever. Exactly. Or we just had, you know, we had apples, just like here's a box of apples or something like that.
Yes.
And I love that. And it was, when you grew up in that context, it's really easy to absorb, to understand. You just know how to behave. Mm-hmm. Actually, it has never left me. And like the trusting that I have because of the upbringing that I got, I wouldn't say it got me in a lot of trouble, but, you know, in terms of trusting the wrong person, just because like one person knew them, therefore that's already, okay, they're part of the clan, all good. The downside of that I felt is like when it comes to that particular German sort of way of living is there was a lot of alcohol, which I couldn't really relate to. The thinking was, oh, look, I mean, it's just not particularly, it's conscious, but it's certainly not enlightened.
Yep.
So I was looking for new thoughts. And maybe that's normal and you want to leave your village. But I had a battle for years and years. And still, it's probably not over, even though the people that I remember are often my parents' age, they're starting to actually die. But it's still one of those things. It's like, wow, I'm not carrying that torch further for that group of people that I was so ingrained in, because there was just quite a bit that I just couldn't agree with.
I would disagree with that, though.
Okay.
Because from what I know of you,
yeah,
you do have a very generous nature.
Right.
And so it's not about necessarily your living circumstances, because you might live on land and you might not have the neighbors and you might not have a trailer or even need one.
I do actually have one, and it's normally not with me. It's normally not with me. It's with other people, which is good.
Exactly, right? So I think that your upbringing taught you, it gave you your nature, gave you your values and your generosity, whereas other people that grow up in a very, you know, we keep everything.
Sort of doggy dog.
Yeah, and we keep everything in here and we don't share and we don't trust strangers and so on. I'm like you in that I'm very trusting.
Yep.
We get a little bit upset when our trust, and sometimes it's our fault. Like we just weren't. It's almost like we weren't pessimistic enough. We weren't skeptical enough. Yeah. We didn't have enough checklists on generosity, you know, I would change nothing. I would not want to be less trusting.
No, that's true.
But I would say, I would challenge you on what you just said, because I would say that you learned so much that you carry on today. Just the environment's different. You're in Northern New South Wales. You're not in the village of Germany, but you still have even look at where you are right now. Mm-hmm. Like this is a little village where we are right now.
You're right.
Helped a few people around here with certain things.
Right. Where it comes to, and that's the age that I'm at now, it's like I'm not in that village helping these older people.
But in that exact.
But you could actually argue, who cares? They're older people
here
too.
And they are just very happy for you to be living your best life.
Yeah.
Because some of the values, John DeMartini says, you know, you can't put your hand in a pot of glue without some of it sticking. So they would be looking at your life going, Sebastian put his hand in the pot of glue of that village life, and it definitely has stuck because you're generous.
Yeah.
Particularly, like, I know of things that you've done for people that is just so kind. I don't know enough about what you would have done around here, but if you reflect on that, and those people in that village would be like, look at Sebastian go, they'd be so happy for you.
I think that's
the process of getting older. Our kids are probably not going to live near us. Maybe we love them too, but when
I was only daughter, so I might have a higher chance.
You know, when we're 70, 80, and 90, but we would like to think that they're carrying on some of what they learned in their earlier years, you know, in their lives.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah.
So when you were talking about that, blue zones can also be sort of the principles and the insights that you get from the blue zones can also come then into our life.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's sort of like the same thing, isn't it? In a sense, although.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
Humans can learn from humans, and we have a shared history. Like I often say because Australia, we're so young, but like, I know Australia, I know we've got indigenous culture, but if we're from a, you know, England, Ireland, Scotland, whatever, we've got this history that we don't necessarily kind of have that ancestral respect that you see in German cultures or Italian cultures or Greek cultures or whatever. But if you take it back far enough, and particularly if you know a bit about where you came from, you know, 200, 300, 400 years ago, you can sense that there's actually culture and wisdom and tradition that we can bring into our lives, mm-hmm. regardless of where we're living in the world. My Sarah's parents live two doors up from us in Mullumbimby. Her two brothers live two streets around the corner. We have like a three-generation lifestyle. Now, it's not my, we didn't, it happened. It was a beautiful coincidence. I think Einstein said coincidence is a God's way of remaining anonymous. You know, there's a universal power in the way that our lives have occurred.
Yeah.
But I think we've got to be really mindful that we don't have to go and live in a blue zone or live in another country to create our great life. We can, if we believe we can, and I know you're very big on manifestation, we can manifest any life as long as it's pure and congruent to us. I can't manifest your life. You can't manifest mine because that's not pure to either one of us. We've got to know thyself and claim it wholeheartedly, which I think older generations were better at that because they might have said, well, we had no other choice. You know, the hard work, simple life, they couldn't just like relocate to Australia. There were no aeroplanes, you know, boats were only hardly invented. But now we've got so much choice. We don't know who we are anymore because we're like, following everyone else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think a simple life makes it much easier to be, I guess, conscious and actually happy. If I think about my gran, like last 15 years, I think she was working in a, what do you call it when metal is stamped out? Like, you know, on a machine and you put holes in it. So,
yeah, I'm terrible at trade. So,
anyway, she was working in manufacturing, so noisy that she couldn't talk to anyone. She would have earplugs in it. And had only their breaks. But what she was doing while she was doing quite a manual labor and quite a mindless task is she was thinking about jokes. She was reflecting about jokes that came earlier that was said maybe before work or, you know, yesterday or so on. And what she said, like, oh, we had so much fun at work, even though they weren't talking the whole time. But she was, I guess, you know, like sort of like calculating her next move, her next joke, and you could see that, you know, she really got on with her workmates, even though they didn't talk the whole time. And I guess the simplicity of actually reflecting, and that comes back to, I mean, you know, the monk who sold the Ferrari, and there's so many other books like that, and insights like that. That's like the simplicity often brings out a lot of beautiful things that you can't be if you're too busy.
Well, the fact that you remember your grandmother's story is amazing. No, honestly, you know how many people listening that wouldn't be able to share stories of their grandparents like that? Like that's just incredible. But I also bet you that your grandmother's little work hack has infiltrated your life as well, where you might be doing something a little bit mindless, but you find a way to be present in the work, but also to think like, this is a terrible admission, but I can be reading my kids a bedtime story and be thinking about something.
Yeah.
I don't know how. When it happens, I'm like,
fascinating.
How can my body and brain do that? But I can be reading the words and the kids can be giggling and laughing.
Yeah.
But then I realize that I'm actually not present with their experience because I'm thinking about, it could be anything, something amazing or something inane. But to your grandmother's story, I know we can't really do two things at once, really, but you kind of can on things that are mindless.
Yeah, yeah.
You can be walking. Anything that's unconscious, I think. You can be walking and you can be driving and you can be planning your whole life at the same time. Fascinating.
I connect well over cooking. I can cook and talk. And again, it's probably something because I grew up with it. I cooked since I've been four, I think, really early. Soup in the beginning.
Where's my dinner invitation?
Yeah. No, that's right.
Yeah.
And I guess talking about sort of doing two things, and there certainly is something about, I guess, what is it called? A walking meditation, a working meditation. You certainly become that. Yeah, you can reflect on things. And also, and that might be, I don't know if it's just a male or female thing, probably not, like both, like, you know, when you have pauses, so you actually contemplate while you talk, but you do something else. So it's, you know, rather than intensively, like we're doing a coffee and we really like bouncing off the chair. It's quite intense.
People would be able to come on here and explain it, but there's got to be two brains. Because to your point, you can be running a meeting and then thinking about something that's
a lot.
So you're kind of having two conversations.
Yes. I'm writing a lot of notes and that have nothing to do with the meeting, but it triggers thoughts and ideas.
So interesting.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah. Humans are fascinating. Wild. So you take people to these blue zones.
We don't do public trips anymore. We only do private trips. So like industry or investors or health professionals or, you know, one company might engage us to take their you know, their leadership team or something. We did public trips for 10 years, but now there's so much interest in our work that we do private trips. But I think it's because the experience, whilst you can live, you can take the wisdom from there and live it here.
Yep.
You can't learn it in, you can't read my book or a Blue Zones book or watch the Netflix Blue Zone series and then just make it happen. There's a very different experience. Like we were saying, recording this podcast in person, you can't replicate it digitally. Yes, we can record the podcast, but we can't have the experience. So, you know, we call our trips a longevity experience. It's not a retreat. It's not a workshop because an experience in life.
Yeah.
Have you ever called your kids on a phone or FaceTime? And it's so different to being in their presence.
I basically don't do it.
Yeah, because it actually doesn't make you feel that
not
great.
Not even my wife.
It's not real.
I probably have talked to her on the phone less than 100 times in the last 10 years.
Wow.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah, like that would be, it might be like when it's really urgent and can't wait that I see the text message. Yeah. But when I'm overseas, it's 7 days of writing.
Yeah, and the other thing is, though, many days it is, in many ways, because, and I wonder if this is part cultural, because I was speaking to a couple of people in Sardinia about this recently, that when they go away from their family, they don't necessarily speak to their family.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people would go, oh, really? But maybe I'm odd one out here. But Ivo, our host in Sardinia, said, yeah, I don't speak to my wife and son much or at all, because I actually, it allows me to be fully present in my work, but it also makes me really, really miss them. So that when he gets home, the hug from his wife and his son, it's like it's something that, you know, technology can't get you anywhere near.
Yeah, you know? Wow. So when you go there, what do you actually do? Like you meet, you sort of experience?
A lot of it's very local, yeah. So we'll go into the locals' home. So again, we've got these beautiful relationships of 10 years, right? So in Sardinia and Icaria, but we go into the locals' homes and we might be cooking with them. I remember this beautiful lady, Athena, who's like I call her the head chef of Icaria. If you've ever seen the Blue Zones recipes, they would have come from Athena. And we went into her home this year because she'd had a hip injury. So she invited us to her home.
Mm.
I don't think she would have done it if we hadn't been going for 10 years, but she said, yep, you can bring your 12, you know, strangers to her into my home. She went and caught her own rabbits and cooked her own rabbit for us, which for the vegans listening, you don't have to have the rabbit. We also had some beautiful wild greens, some horta for those that know they're Greek. And we went and picked the greens out of her garden again, because she's got a hip injury. So we're picking the greens and the zucchini and the eggplant from her garden. And then we'd stuff them and cook them with her. And then we would all sit around and eat with Athena, and we would ask her questions and learn about life. And I literally had a grown man crying at the table. And I said to Mick, I said, why?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I haven't had that type of experience
for
years. And he said, and would I bring 12 people that I don't know into my family home?
Yeah.
And would I collect my own vegetables and cook them? And would I kill my own rabbits to feed to strangers? And so I came back from this trip this year saying, you know, longevity is love and love is longevity, because the activities that we have over there, people feel this emotional availability that they just don't feel at home. And you see that these people have so much emotional availability, so much love, and it's unsettling for a lot of people. It brings tears to their eyes and it really does make you question what you do. But we could be cooking, we could be hiking, we could be swimming in Mediterranean, of course, we could be going to a winery, we could be going to an apiary and seeing how the bees behave and tasting the honey. We're going to festivals and dancing. We're having, you know, talks around the table, you know, little longevity workshops. We're going to flour mills and learning about bread. We're going to olive groves and learning about olive oil. It's all areas of life. Going into churches and everything and anything, and it changes every year based on how our relationships deepen and activities. But I shouldn't talk about it because I'll talk about it forever and we'll be but it's something very special, that's for sure.
You got a book.
Mm-hmm.
I'll get that in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Is it sort of like what you were saying, put in writing?
Well, because we've got kids, you can appreciate this. I realized in about 20 14 or 15. I had four clients in a room at a mini retreat, and I did an exercise with them called 180 Days to Live. Mm. And this was the focus was a wealth creation workshop. And so you got the book up there. For those of you listening, Sebastian's holding the book up. Life,
make the rest of your life the best of your life.
That's
Marcus
the one.
Beautiful.
So what I did with these clients, we were doing all of this wealth creation stuff. And then it was like, okay, if you were to get hit by a bus in 180 days, what would change on your list? And all of a sudden people are like, oh, the life insurance documents are sitting under a pile of paper. We never get to them. And I've got to repair a relationship with my mom or my brother or whatever it is. And so it became nothing about wealth in many ways. Well, kind of like life insurance, and you want your family to be looked after. But it all became like our impending mortality, whether it's 180 days or 180 years away, if you ask Dave Asprey, but it's going to happen, right? So I realized that my kids really know nothing of, they think their dad helps people live a happy life. And that's a great thing.
Yeah.
If you ask my kids, what does dad do? He helps people live a happy life.
Yeah. Great.
And when I'm traveling a lot, my oldest daughter is now like, can't these people figure it out for themselves? Why do you have to go and teach them how to live a great life? Can't they just do it themselves? That's her now frustration when I'm away from home. But I realized my kids didn't have anything on what their dad thought on how to live a great life. So I started waking up, Robin Sharma, 5 a.m. Club.
Mm.
I got up at 5 a.m. every morning to write a manuscript on all of the research. I've done hundreds of interviews with centenarians and graceful ages, and I've been traveling to Ikaria and doing all of this stuff. I thought, my kids don't have a manual on how to live.
Uh-huh.
So that was my inspiration for getting up and having a green tea every morning and writing. So I wrote for an hour a day. Uh-huh. That became the manuscript. And then 5 years later, version 14 of the book is came out in 2021. So that was 14 drafts later, because I'm a bit detail oriented. journalist by profession.
Yeah.
So it's to everything that we've been speaking about. Longevity for me is purpose, movement, and social.
Mm-hmm.
Quality of life plan is nutrition, family, growth, and wealth. And then our heart and soul plan is our spirit, soul, and faith. We've got to infuse that into those preceding areas. And so that's the book. The book's in three parts: longevity, quality of life, heart and soul. And I would like to think it's my life's work.
Beautiful.
Mm.
I'm sure there will be version two.
Maybe.
You know, when I think about sort of your reflections there of I guess how to live a good life and what that takes, and that you take people to that place. Do you have a bit of a recipe for people? Actually, I like your, I just forgot that. I like that you sort of say, what would you do if you only live 180 days? Fairly recently, recorded about 45 minutes of like, hey, wife, if I die, this is how I would structure things. This is what I would do. Here's the permission I give you. Live your life the way that you want. You know, like, I will not judge you from anything you do. This is now your life, you know, same with the kids and so on. And here's how I would put the affairs in order. And that was very practical. Because I know that's important to have, because it's like, ooh, this is quite a bit of a construct here. So I would not know what to do. And, you know, are we actually fine? And you know, because that's in our relationship more my than her area. So legal stuff, setups, sort of that.
Yeah.
But what it did to me is like, I became more comfortable of like being not here forever. And at the same time, also sort of appreciating that I'm right now here and what I've got, you know, when you're faced with, at one stage, you won't have that anymore, maybe sooner than you think.
Mm-hmm.
It makes things more precious, I found. So that is a super nice
Absolutely.
Exercise, right?
That's, precious, for sure.
But you might have also other ways to sort of kick that happiness, that blue zone thinking into people. And there might be different ones depending on their age.
So this is so interesting. There's a book I've got to give you after this interview. So 180 days to live is really, I think, a great thing, because it can happen. I'm driving home.
Mm.
I'm holding on to this Toyota Orion until my daughter gets her L's, and then that's her car. And it is a really safe car, but it's also really old.
Right.
So I'm often like, will this car be the death of me, or will it be the beginning of May's driving career? But when I drive home, anything can happen.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter the car that I'm in, but anything can happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's important to recognize that life is unpredictable.
Mm.
At the same time, for everyone that listens to this podcast or watches it, We live in countries that live a great long life. So in Australia, the average is 83 years of age, but I'm 44. Huh. I'm a 1 in 5 chance to hit 100.
Mm-hmm.
A 70-year-old is 1 in 10. A newborn, you've got an 18-month-old, flip of the coin to hit 100. Oh. So we have to prepare. Wealth is a really big one, and exits and structures and so on. But we must prepare that barring the unpredictable, we're going to live a long time. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the challenge. The wealthier nations have terrible morbidity profiles. So injury and illness profiles are terrible in wealthier nations. So in Australia, we are the second worst for quality of life as we get older. And no one will talk about this.
No, surprise. 12.1
years. So technically or statistically, at 70.9 years of age, it all goes downhill from here until you're 83 because you have injury and illness. You fall downstairs and break a hip. You're polypharmacy. You're on 5 medications. You're on this to manage that and this to manage that. And your social life is in the waiting rooms of the doctor's offices and so on and so forth. 12.1 years. The worst country is America, 12.4 years. The less wealthy nations have smaller morbidity because they've got shorter longevity. You know, so we've got to be really clear here that if you're living in a developed wealthy nation, you're going to live a very long time.
Mm.
So do you want average longevity, which is 12.1 years of morbidity, or do you want exceptional longevity where what I call you're playing the and game? You're inspired. You've got physical vitality. You've got social connection. You've got energy from a great diet. You've got love in your family. You're enthusiastic in your growth and hobbies. You've got financial independence because you've spent less than you've earned and invested the difference. And you're fulfilled in the world. The world's a great place. And you've mastered the art of that fulfillment. So that's the more structured way that I think is, again, you go to the Blue Zones, they don't have to think like this. They don't have to think of their 8 areas of life and consciously create it because it's been built into their culture and taught by their families from a very young age just through meal times. They don't eat dinner in front of the TV. They're like, that doesn't make any sense. They wouldn't even get it. So we've just got to be really mindful of our life design. Because we live in a developed nation, typically we require structure. We read books. We plan our lives, whether it's our financial lives or our life by design. So my view is, yes, anything can change today or in 180 days, but you also want to be cognizant of the fact that you want to have a life design that goes into the 80s, 90s, 100s.
Lifespan versus health span then as well, right?
They're the buzzwords.
Yeah. It's a fairly recent term, isn't it?
I think, Peter Attia and Professor David Sinclair are probably the ones that have popularized the terms. I think the terms are not, I don't know if we really care about the terms. How does it impact you?
Oh, I think it's great to know that concept.
Yeah, concepts are important. So you want to live a long life. Most people want to live a long life, but a lot of people don't because they've seen their parents age poorly and they think that
really?
Might be the same.
That's true.
And they buy into the genetic trap, and that's not a thing. Let's just put that out there. I can show you so many people that have the worst genes ever and live great long lives. So let's just put that out there. But also, health span is not as simple as having a great diet. If you have really poor relationships with your parents, you are a 100% chance, according to Harvard research, to have a major medical crisis in your midlife. But if that happens, do we stick a needle in your arm and go, oh, your relationship with your dad is strained and cold. Oh, you're just tolerant of your mum, but you're like suppressing all this anger and frustration. It doesn't happen that way. It's like, oh, you've got high cholesterol. Let's just give you that pill. When I go, I wonder what's contributing to that. You know,
so whether it has anything to do with that I'm Scorpio or not, but Scorpios are really interested in psychology,
I love
right?
Scorpio. Honestly, I do. My best friends are Scorpios.
They're often deep, and so when it comes to sort of psychology, I watch people. This is why I often have little to no neighbors because I'm a little bit scared of thinking too much about other people.
Yeah. Your shadow self would be sensitive to other people and their thoughts.
In a sense of like, really?
Mm.
I have an idea here, whether it's any better is beside the point. But, you know, like that's where my mind goes. My family knows that because I think a lot about them. It's just how it is.
Mm-hmm.
But so what I do as well is I track people and I track events in their life. It's like, oh, that was a full-on event. I wonder. And what I've learned is like, you can't see the consequences straight away. But it seems to me that people in life encounter challenges.
Mm-hmm. Could be a difficult co-worker, could be a massive breakup or not breaking up, staying in a relationship that really derails after a while and so on. And what comes after that is often some sort of sickness and or depression or, you know, some of these things. And I found it fascinating to watch these people. Most people don't have the tools and, you know, not the tools. And therefore, they actually really get sick. So when you talk about health span, for me, health span is not just the body.
Correct.
And there's the body-mind connection that is undeniable and to quite a degree actually researched now, luckily. But I can see that the tools are not taught at school normally, like how you get over, I don't know, imposter syndrome or feeling just not worthy or whatever it might be, you know, or you know, setting boundaries with someone else who really impacts you negatively and so on.
I do wonder, though, as simple as this sounds, so many of these challenges are often that we feel so lonely in our bag of problems. And I just wonder, 100 years ago, maybe even not that many years ago, our friends and family were a lot closer to us. We were talking about these things over the dinner table.
Certainly.
And so, to use a Tony Robbins word, we'd kill the monster whilst it was small because it was dealt with over a few meals, breakfast, lunch, or dinner. We had more connection, which meant I feel that we had more vulnerability because it wasn't a sign of weakness to have things happening that, you know, you were scared of, anxious about, you'd made mistakes, owning up to it. I'm not saying the old days were like some nirvana, but from a social connection perspective, there's views that 50% of mental health would disappear if we all got into the kitchen and ate around the table. I kind of get it. I can see that.
Definitely.
Because so many people are so alone that it's become so toxic and chronic that they don't know how to get out of it. And then they don't have the tools, but they also don't have the people because of however many cultural, you know, nudges have lent them into that isolation.
Yep. No, I agree with that.
You know, phones is one thing. We've got all the tools on Instagram and they're all, everything's going to save our lives. 6 minute abs. Everything's going to save our lives like that, but we can't talk to anyone about it. We sign up for the program, but we can't talk to anyone. It's our own private journey.
Yeah. I've put stuff in place. Hey, like, so I do breath work once a month for a solid 3 hours. Breath work now is probably two hours breathing.
Yep.
And then a bit of conversation before and after.
Yes.
John, my breath worker, amazing guy. I do it online.
Yeah, nice.
And that's one thing that really resets sort of like some fears and some sadness and brings emotion out that otherwise gets stuck, right? And which I believe is a major
absolutely.
One.
Absolutely. Breath work's phenomenal for that.
No, no.
Absolutely.
And so simple. Cheap.
Very. And it's so natural. It's like breathing.
Yeah, really.
You don't need 38 different, you know.
No, that's right. But then, you know, that so I think that's probably more an emotional thing. And then there's also the sort of I'm part of YPO, which has like a gestalt style thing where you describe sort of the different parts of your life, which is personal, family, and business.
Yes.
And you give updates on there. And mine, boyish, you said there are, was like, well, how's it going? Like, what's the top five and bottom 5% of this? And it puts that mind really on it and acknowledge, I guess, you know, yes, there is actually an issue. Actually, if I think about it a little bit deeper, yes, there's quite a bit.
Yeah.
And then you have a group of between 7 and 9 people in the room that then have tools that we use to do certain things in a particular way. And so I guess back in the day is what natural to, I don't know, gather around the water place almost, you know, and chat it through. And someone has been there, done that, and they give you a bit of advice and say, like, look, you know, let's sit down tonight. I tell you what I... You know, maybe, you know, the wife says, yeah, my husband used to get his knickers in the twist when he was talking about X, Y, and Z. Here's how we got that unstuck together. Talk to him. He actually has a story to tell as well. So I guess that is the social connection that you can't really find in reels on YouTube or whatever.
But also because you've developed a relationship with your YPO members that you feel comfortable. Takes time, takes some muscle. To actually do it, but it probably comes to a point where you not only look forward to it, but you don't know what you'd do without that that village, that community. Mm. And community is definitely one of the most important elements to life. And often the best thing is with technology is that there are a lot of digital communities, but when they meet in the flesh, it's very special. So the digital side of things is amazing, And I think it's incredible that we can have all of these relationships. And then I've just been at an event on the weekend where it's a digital community. And then once a year, mm-hmm. they come together.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow.
Makes a difference.
Yeah. Well, it's not just, it amplifies the experience. Like yes. I was saying to you earlier, you know, I did an event with a YPO chapter and it was amazing to have them in the room together. Again, I said there was, you know, grown men crying and it's like, would that have happened? It may happen over Zoom. But sometimes there's a lot more something undeniable about, yeah, in the flesh.
Have you ever worn those goggles that give you like the virtual reality?
Augmented reality, yeah.
It's pretty convincing. I wonder whether some people will bridge sort of their loneliness by meeting that way, but I don't think it would be ever the same.
There's something kind of like science controlling nature. Yeah. I just feel like I'm a romantic. I just feel like nature will always have the final say.
Yes.
I don't know. I do think about this stuff, but because like, so longevity, there's so much movement in the longevity space and, you know, Brian Johnson says dying is optional and, you know, just don't die. And Dave Asprey, 180 and Professor David Sinclair says aging is a disease. And as soon as we cure that disease, then we don't have to age. And a part of me is like, if you were to live to 180, how would you plan your life? Would you work until you were 160 and retire? Like if you're 40 and thinking you had 120 years of working left, what would you think? The constructs of science and nature to this point of like, you know, if we put the goggles on and would it feel the same? I just think nature has a way of giving us the wisdom of how to live. And we can have these, not calling them little hacks, but we can wear the goggles. It's like fast food.
Mm-hmm.
Wear the goggles a bit. Knock yourself out.
Yeah.
5 minutes, an hour.
Yeah.
But if that becomes your life, like KFC and Macca's becomes your life, I think, you know, it's all about dosage, right? We know this in health. Dosage is the thing.
Like the wine and the blue zones.
Exactly, yeah, right. Totally right. You know, yeah. So, yeah.
And actually to your point earlier, also like what is life, you know, work-life balance, sort of weird thing. One of my mentors, he is 83. One of his mentors was Joseph Campbell, but they were also like, what's a futurist called? Buckminster Fuller. Ron Stotz, actually, he was on my podcast. And so he's in his 80s. You wouldn't know. I would say like 60s maybe or something like that. And he's like, why would I stop working?
Totally.
You know, and then that's sort of like that blend of like, yeah, you know, that I get 70% on average are not happy with their work. And that's unfortunate. I hope this will change. And it might be because there's a lot more. It's not the task itself. So like how the culture is set up around it and so on, how you treat it.
It's like your grandmother. So. Like there may have been people in that place that didn't like their work because they just give it the work. But then there's.
Yeah, but the social element was so uplifting and so important to her that was beside the point.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess I watch him and he's like, I hope I would do this, at, you know, until I die, really. Like, you know, he's at the top of his game. He just started a new job as a director of a particular neuro psychology department. And that's really inspiring to me.
Why would you ever want to stop doing what you love and loving what you do?
There's
research around the two, you know, most dangerous years of your life, the year that you're born and the year that you retire. Like, you can see it. Your purpose drops off the perch. For a lot of people, the social life drops off the perch. The fun drops off the perch. Their brain's not engaged in solving problems and working stuff out. Like, imagine.
My dad is a grief counselor, and he knows that that's the point where people just really need to figure out what they actually do afterwards. Because if there's no purpose anymore, then, you know, the body somehow gets the message.
They rot in front of the TV.
Read something last week from Peter Diamandis that two key moments in your life. The first one is when you were born. The second one, when you figured out why.
Why?
And I thought that was powerful ass because I think I think this is where school hopefully will move to, is like find your passion.
Mm-hmm.
Working in a sense will be more and more optional, but that doesn't mean that it's not important. Like you have to find somehow your passion. And if it is growing your olive growth or, you know, whatever it is, it just needs to be something that gives you purpose.
So this is the just quick story. So the CEO of Deloitte Canada grew up in Casino, New South Wales.
Did he?
couple of hours or an hour south of where you and I are right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah.
And somehow he found my book.
Uh-huh.
Right. And Purpose is the first 80 or 40 pages of the book.
Mm.
And I say that purpose is the number one ingredient for longevity. It's the number one.
Mm-hmm.
And so he does a shout out one day on LinkedIn to the favorite books that he's read over summer. And lo and behold, he references my book amongst some other incredible books. And I track him down, find his email, and I say, thank you so much. I didn't know he was Australian at this point.
But yeah.
I said, thank you so much. How did you come across
yeah.
my book? Because mine came out during COVID when bookstores were illegal, so it doesn't have mass distribution.
Yeah,
It's popular in Australia. But he said, well, I grew up in Casino when I was in Byron, and I saw it at the book room at the store. And
oh, true. Yeah, yeah.
And he said, I'd love you to come and talk to my 1,200 partners.
Yes.
and I said, what about? He yep. said, all about purpose.
Ah.
And because he gets it.
Yeah.
Doing what you love and loving what you do is not just a nice thing to have. It's the reason that we get out of bed.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get out of bed to be like, oh, just mm-hmm. get through the day.
Mm-hmm.
The reason that we were born, the one in 400 trillion chance that you were born was not just because. It wasn't just to survive, to Diamandis' point.
Mm.
When you figure out why, you won that one in 400 trillion chance race.
Mm.
There is a
powerful.
A fire in that belly
yeah.
that is
yeah.
pretty hard to stop. But yeah. doing the work to find that clarity, again, mine is to help people create exceptional lives, and that's as a parent or a brother or a friend or a speaker or whatever it is. But for people to know what that is, that'll bounce you out of bed quicker than anything else in your life.
Would you say that following a sports club for some people is that?
Oh, there's a sport, and again, I'm an ex-sport journalist. There is something about sport that gets people going more than most things. But there's community in there. There's purpose in there. Yes. A lot of the time, it's my relationship to my dad is built on the fact that he took me to sport most Saturdays growing up. Like when I think of Melbourne Football Club, I think of my dad. There's a family element to there. There's growth and fun. Yeah, sport is it's a whole nother episode. It is a phenom sport, or it's an enigma. I don't know how it is so compelling, but it absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why, but I try to stay clear of it. Every now and then I got roped in or felt like really, really yeah. strongly about watching. In Germany, it was tennis, Formula One.
Yeah.
Look, actually, soccer post people. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I had
you interviewed a soccer player that played in the Bundesliga.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. I know a few actually. So over the years through our work with Clearlight, and now I know a few sort of ex-Wallabies and yes. that type of thing. And it's fascinating. And I would ask them, like, what is it like to become that purpose, you know, or be part of the story that people focus on?
Yeah,
you know, it's an interesting one, but I was just wondering, it's like, okay, you know, that's one way of feeling purpose, supporting your
absolutely
club.
But to that point of your experience with professional athletes, your purpose can change, because for a lot of professional athletes, by the time they're in their mid-30s,
yes,
they're no longer professional athletes.
No.
And then they fall off the perch.
Ooh, and go, it's a big one.
My whole life, I've been the rock star. I've yeah. been adulated. I've been congratulated. Mm. I've been
recognized always in the street, that type
yeah,
of thing.
I've yeah. been endorsed.
Yeah.
I've been everything.
Yeah.
And now I've lost all my relevance. I've lost all my purpose. And people can appreciate this. A mum can feel this when their youngest child goes to school and they're like, oh my gosh,
yeah.
the house is empty. The house is quiet. But my whole purpose is built around the home and the people in this home. Who am I? What was the one in 400 trillion chance reason that I was born now? Like the chapters, I'm pretty big into 7-year cycles. Don't be surprised if those answers change every 7 years, or at least mature, because life is not so static that you just have one purpose and you're done. You can have multiple purposes over your life, and we can't be afraid of that. That's for sure.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Something to be aware of before it happens, actually, in a sense. And that's sort of like to the retirement thing, which is similar, like, you know, when yeah. then a phase stops, and that's one that you don't have a choice about because your kid will grow up, recognizing, ah, this is the phase that is coming to an end now. What's my strategy here? And I think in this time you have to be quite intentional to sort of bridge that.
And older people, again, I do a lot of work with retirement villages, older people come up to me and often recognize that they gave up on their physical vitality because society said that you slow down as you get older, and they quit their jobs, sold their businesses, stopped doing what they love too early. And they go, oh my gosh, it's time. And then thankfully, a lot of these people that I speak to, they go back and re-engage in their favorite sports or physical activities, re-engage in work. If they made doors, they'll go back to making doors. If they want to go in a men's shed, if they were an accountant, they might help a couple of people out with their affairs. And it's never a good time to stop. It's a great line. Always too early, never too early to start and always too soon to stop. Like you never want to stop doing what you love. You know,
that's beautiful.
Really important.
I could talk for hours and we should continue this.
Yeah. More than happy to do it again.
Terrific. Well, I thank you very much for sharing everything. Thank you so much for doing this work, because the insight that people get out of it are really tools that, you know, help to live a long and happy and fulfilled life, which to me is like, what else would you thrive for us for that, right?
Yeah. That's the reason to live, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Thanks for having me, Sebastian.
Marcus, I enjoyed that. Thank you so much.